Hi, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Think Exchange podcast, and I am absolutely delighted today to have a wonderful friend of mine and a great music supervisor, Sarah Webster, online with us today. Sarah, how are you?
I'm doing really well, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for coming. Why don't we begin from the beginning? Why don't you tell us how you got into the music business in general and how you sort of evolved in your career?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story, actually. So it's funny that you ask. And, you know, I'll take you back to June of 1988, and I was in grade 8, and we were watching The Outsiders on the last day of English class. And
right.
We were allowed to watch a movie because it was the last day of school. We'd read the book in grade 8 English, right? And, of course, being a 13-year-old girl, I was happy to watch the movie with Emilio Estevez and Matt Dillon and all the, you know, all the rap bad guys of the 80s. So I'm watching this movie, and over the end credits is, you know, Stevie Wonder, who wrote the song specifically, Stay Gold, for the movie.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this as a 13-year-old girl, and the thought comes into my mind, who does this? Who's in charge of this? Whose job is it to put music in movies? That is genius. Whoever had him write the song for the movie, this is just genius. I love this. I forgot about that. I carry on. As a teenager, I really became involved in house music, in the burgeoning house music scene that was happening on the West Coast in the late 80s and the early 1990s. So I was into DJ culture. I was, you know, following DJs around from New York and Chicago who were playing deep, lush, orchestral house music. And I actually got tapped there by a startup software development company. A bunch of guys were leaving EA, Electronic Arts. They'd had it with making video games, and they wanted to make some music products that were usable in a PlayStation 2 console, which is a super smart idea.
Right.
So they hired me to do all the licensing for the music because, of course, none of the DJs were phoning these software nerds back. And so they didn't know anybody at the labels and the publishers, and they said, Webster, you got to help us. We need some music. I said, no problem. So I went to work in software development, funnily enough, licensing music for products built for video game consoles. And I did that around the millennium, and I moved to New York City in 2002 to go and work for a really hot, probably the hottest record label of the moment, and it was called Naked Music.
Right.
And I lived in New York for a year. I worked for Naked. I also worked for Satellite Records. After a year, my visa was up. I had to go back to Vancouver, and I thought, what am I going to do here? And I was looking for music-related jobs, of course, and I realized that in my research, there was a company that had a music supervision department, and I emailed the woman right away and said, you need to hire me. I know how to license music. I'm a genius creatively, and I've been living in New York, and we have to get together, and she called me right away.
This is why I like you, because you're like me. You're just like, I'm just going to go out there. I'm going to put myself out there in what I love and do it.
Oh, that's how you have to do it. I mean, there's never
going
to be an ad in the paper. The department was not hiring. There was a music supervisor who, unfortunately, was, you know, speaking and closing deals was not his strength. So the department was suffering.
Right.
Financially, they were hemorrhaging money, and they brought me in and said, if you want to make money, you need to figure out how to do this. Mark, I had no idea. I knew how to license music out because I'd worked at a record label.
Sure.
I knew how to license, you know, our catalog out for business opportunities. Business development was my thing. But I had never licensed music for film. So I literally had no idea what to do. Somebody said something about a film list. So I figured out that each province had a film commission. I'm living in Vancouver at the time. So I started printing out the film commission film list for each province and cold calling producers, showrunners, directors, writers, whoever I could get on the phone, pitching my skills, saying, I know the language of licensing. I know how to do this for you. And I know great music. Let's give it a whirl. And I landed my first gig. And then after my first gig, I landed my second gig. And, you know, just as important as choosing the music and dealing with that whole creative side of it, it's also extremely creative in seeking and then closing deals to actually get the show in the first place.
Almost everybody I talk to, their beginnings come from a combination of passion and hard work. So it seems like that's really where, you know, you sort of position yourself and you're like, look, I've got the skills. I can do this. I've done this work before.
Yeah.
Bring me in and I'll fix it for you.
Yeah, totally. You need me on your team. I went to Canada's largest leading entertainment company. It's a music management company. They managed Leonard Cohen, Nora Jones, Elvis Costello, Dana Crawl, you know,
which
lots
one
of
is
people.
It?
It's called Feldman and Associates. That's all.
Okay,
Feldman
I know
and Associates.
Them. Yeah.
They're the big, that's the company in Canada.
Yep.
And they have a booking agency. They have agents. Well, they hired me on as sort of an assistant in the music supervision department. And I got down to business, Mark. I was told if I wanted to make money, I had to earn money. I had to bring it in. So I learned to print those production lists. I cold called and hustled and created business out of nothing and asked the guy who was there at the time to teach me. He gave me a template for licensing, a sync template and a master template. And unfortunately, he was let go shortly afterwards. And I was asked to leave the department, which I did. And I got us up and going and got lots of shows happening. And then a couple of years later, they made me a VP, an executive. And I spent a few more years there before I left in 2009 to go and be independent.
What made you make the decision to become independent?
Well, it was just sort of, you know, a realization that it's a lifestyle thing, you know, it's
right.
A lifestyle thing. I want to work at home. I mean, the lifestyle, the Feldman office is pretty awesome, I have to tell you. It's on the water in Vancouver and the marina. There's parks everywhere. It's dog friendly. I would take my dogs to the office every day. So it was a good group of people, you know, you're working with music agents and whatnot. It's a fun gang. But it just seemed to me, you know, the time came where I, you know, started to study yoga. And I thought perhaps if I could swing this myself, being self-employed and teaching some yoga as well, that might be a really sweet lifestyle balance. So I left, and sure enough, my clients all came with me. They all chased me down. I didn't go after anyone. I thought I would just teach yoga for a while, and I built a yoga studio and opened a business. And all the while, I had projects coming to me, TV shows, movies. And of course, in Canada, the fees are so low, right? So you're doing half a dozen shows at once. I had, I don't know how many staff. I built the department up. I had a roster of score composers. I was also acting as an agent to about
right.
a dozen award-winning score composers. And I had an intern and a couple of assistants.
So at the same time that you had a yoga studio, you were running
yeah.
this department, basically farming people out to do scores as well as doing licensing.
For sure. Yeah, lots. Lots going on.
You're a hard worker. So
You gotta be. Hey, we could talk about real estate prices in Vancouver. It's worse than New York. I mean, you gotta be a hard worker.
Yeah, you do. You really do.
You gotta pay the mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. You've gotta come up with the mortgage every month or the rent, whatever the case is. Yeah.
Dogs ain't paying it.
So at this point, did you make a decision to move to Los Angeles and set up shop? How did that go?
That came later. I left Feldman in 2009, and in 2011, Gold Circle Films, a production company I'd worked with for years. I'd done Slither for them and White Noise 2 back in the day. They came
right.
to me in the spring of 2011 with a script, and they said, "We're not sure if we should make this movie. Will you read it and let us know what you think?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I read the script, and I said, "Guys, I want 2 weeks. I said, I need to go and get ballpark quotes on every one of these songs in order to have a ballpark idea of what we can land this budget at. And I want to give you guys a proper answer, a thorough answer. So if you're asking me if you're going to greenlight this film, I need to do my due diligence, and I need to get on paper ballpark quotes from every single licensor involved in every single song." There were 80 songs in the script. This is the first Pitch Perfect movie. So I spent 2 weeks. I got on paper every single ballpark quote, put together my budget, went back to the producers with everything on paper, said, "Here you go, this is what I think you can do it for." They said, "Rock and roll, let's make the movie." I said, "Rock and roll." So we made the movie. And then the movie did so well, I phoned an immigration lawyer. After it had come out and the soundtrack had released, the soundtrack started getting nominated for a Billboard Award and American Music Award. You know, we were getting all these nominations and things. And so I phoned an immigration lawyer and said, "Can I get out of the rain now?" And she said, "Absolutely." So I was able to obtain a visa and come down here and be sponsored and work independently. So I can contract for anyone, and I work legally here in the U.S., which is great. You know, it's the Pitch Perfect. The short answer is the Pitch Perfect movies brought me to America.
That's fantastic. And then that acted as a springboard for other projects that you've worked on, right?
Mm-hmm. It's the truth. It's the honest truth. Those, every time I hear the soundtrack, I get a tear in my eye. Those movies brought me to the U.S.
Is this a good market for you to work in and expand your career?
Oh, my gosh. I love it, Mark. You know me. I felt such an eccentric in Vancouver, you know,
right.
doing my thing, doing music for film, you know, living my life, chasing off around India. And here in Santa Monica, in Los Angeles, I honestly feel like I'm so conservative and everyone else is such a wingnut. So I feel right at home with all the eccentric, the beautiful eccentric beings that make up this great city that is Los Angeles.
So let's change tracks a little bit. We've talked a little bit about who you are and how you came up. Let's talk a little bit about process. Basically, when you, as a music supervisor, are working with a project, we can use Pitch Perfect as an example, but it could be easily a game, or it could be a TV show, whatever. What are the sort of steps that you take once you've signed on to a project?
Well, it depends on where the project is. So that's the first big factor, right? Because we get called on, music supervisors get called on, as I just explained, before the movie's even greenlit, in the very last hour when they're about to open, you know, Berlin Film Festival in a week and they haven't licensed any music. Like, it depends on where the project is. So ideally, we're brought on board way in pre-production, and then we have time to clear anything we need to clear for on camera.
Right.
And then we can supply temp music, because another big deal for music supervisors is the temp, because what inevitably happens is editors put in a lot of iTunes music, a lot of top 40.
Yep.
And then the editors will cut to it, and then I'm trying to replace it. But they have a grand for the cue, not 200 grand.
Yeah.
So I have to play. So it becomes very difficult. So, I mean, ideally, the process for me is that I supply the temp, you know, that I can control what's going in the soundtrack based on A, creative first, you know, foremost always, and B, budget, because I'm never going to put anything in that we can't get, because it makes me look bad.
Right. And that's the key. If you can get in at the beginning, that's really where you want to be, because that way you're controlling the process to some degree. Creatively, you have that conversation that you need to have, which is always the number one thing, with the showrunner, the director, the game developer, whoever it is. And, you know, you have a sense of where their musical palette is in their head that sits with what they're doing. And then you have to sit down and say, okay, so we've got like three columns, right? What's easy, what's impossible, and what's attainable but hard?
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of make that work, right?
Totally. I go after everything. I always go after everything as best I can. Because, again, it's due diligence, and it shows my clients that I really care, which I do. I'm really invested in this department, in this soundtrack. I'm really caring about what's going on here. So I go after everything. I'll try and get everything. I'll try and get Pink Floyd for a short film. I'll try, you know. Because I'm an optimist, too. I'm also an optimist. And the thing is, these deals change all the time, as you know.
That's true.
And so I don't know, whoever it was with last week, they might not be with that person this week, right? They might be with a nice guy and not a grumpy lady, or you know what I mean? So I go after everything.
A completely different label or publisher, you know, from one week to the next, right?
Yeah. So what I do is I put together my spreadsheet, and then I let my clients know my status report at the end of every day. And I show them, this is the song that you want for this cue. I am going after it. Here's where we are at with that song, i.e. 2/3 cleared, 1/2 cleared, whatever. And B, here are all the replacement ideas that sound alike, that have a similar tone, that have a similar feel, a similar sentiment, and they're clearable within budget.
Right.
So there's so many moving pieces all at once, right? I've got so many moving pieces just for one cue at once. I'm trying to push the deal forward for the song they want. I'm trying to find replacements. And I pre-clear all my replacements too, right? I don't know that music supervisors do that, but I do that. I don't give anything that isn't 100% pre-cleared. Not just an okay from the label. I want to know who the co-pubs are. I want to know who the co-master owners are. And I need it all on paper before I even pitch it to my clients. So my front-end load is heavy. But that's why I'm successful. Because I don't ever get them in bed with anything they can't have. Because, you know what, half the shows I've done are directors, grown men and producers coming to me with tears in their eyes, saying, please help us. We had a music supervisor. They put all these songs in. We have no paperwork. We can't get anything. They won't answer our phone calls. Do you know how often I hear that? It dropped my jaws on the floor. Like,
that's absolutely mind-blowing to me, because I would think you know, if you're working as a music supervisor, right, you've got to think of it this way. You've got the choices that the person wants, and then you've got to have sort of something in the quiver, right? You've got to have something that's like sitting there where you can go,
backstage,
here's three things for you to listen to, with like you said, like the same sentiment, the same feeling. So, you know, they're not just totally high and dry going, oh my God, what are we going to do here? I just, and they can get excited about, you know, choice B. I mean, it's managing their expectations while at the same time always making sure that they've got another choice.
Correct.
But, and that's where I think a lot of people can really have to think about how they can position themselves with music supervisors in terms of whether or not they work with a rep company or a publisher or a label or a manager, how they can make sure that when the time is right, their music will be probably represented to a music supervisor that may need it for a project, because either it's the right music from the first, you know, from like the A-list choices, or it's something that can replace something that's ended up being too difficult to get.
Right.
I'll ask you, in terms of where you source music for, okay, they have their plan A a lot of the time and they think they know what they want, but then if there's like a plan B, like where do you go to find that music? You know, where are your sources for that?
You know, I go to the people that I meet. I try to keep really current. So obviously I have my favorite publishers that I have licensed from my entire career, which is 15 years.
Of course.
So I have my tried and true. And you know what? It's based on personality above catalog. You know, I go to the people and there's, I mean, every catalog is a great catalog. There's so much great music in every catalog. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I go to the people that are really like you, who are just cheerful and lovely and proactive and just want to do great business and get things done and have a smile and have a laugh. And so I have my regulars and then I keep it very current. So I do have an ongoing spreadsheet and I constantly put people's contact info in there that I come across. So for example, when I go to Sync Summit with you, I come home and I implement all those business cards so that when I reach out, I send a brief is what I do. As soon as I figure out how many cues there are in the show and what I'm looking for, and once I have a sort of budget idea for each cue, I have a map really. Once I've mapped it out by a spreadsheet, my own self, then I can send out a brief list.
Right.
And I'll send different briefs to different companies. And they always go to third parties. So they're licensing companies, they're publishing companies, and they're record labels. And oftentimes they pass them on and they say, hey, sir, I don't have anything like that. You know, I'll mistakenly send it to a country label and I'm looking for, like, I don't know, hip hop or something. And she'll say, hey, how are you? How are the dogs? Don't have anything but phone this guy.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's a great community. I mean, you know, our community of music professionals is a really great community.
I agree. And I think that that's a really good point that you just brought up that I always say to people is that, look, you have to, first of all, you have to look at it as a community and you have
yeah.
to look at it as you're being part of the community.
Yes.
As part of the community, you should do two things that are, you know, I think a must. One thing is if you don't have music to meet a brief, don't send something just for the sake of sending something and hope
yeah.
that they might want to hear it. And
yeah.
then secondly, if you can be helpful and say, actually, I know somebody who's got Colombian salsa music. I
yes.
certainly don't, but why don't
yes.
you talk to this guy? And,
yes.
you know, Everybody should look out for each
totally.
Other and build goodwill.
Hey, I agree. Music supervisors will call me and say, how did you clear No Diggity in the first Pitch Perfect film? And I'm like, yeah, that's a bummer, right? Here's the spreadsheet. Here it outlines all the writers, all the percentage splits, all the publishing companies. We're all music supervisors. We're all on the same team.
At the end of the day,
me too.
You have to have a proactive attitude and you have to be helpful. But also,
yeah.
the other thing is, going back to what you were saying about clearance, and I
yeah.
know that I say this again and again like a broken record, but people
yeah.
need to make sure that no matter
yeah.
what, no matter how good your music is, and it can be
yeah.
the best music in the world, if you
yeah.
don't present it with the proper rights clearance,
I know.
It's
it doesn't
meaningless.
Matter.
Yeah.
It's meaningless.
I think that's one of those things where people really need to know that if they're going to present something, they need to present it knowing that it's 100% cleared, or, you know, if it's a song that's maybe a little bit more complicated, that they can
yeah.
get it easily cleared. Give us a little bit of insight in what some of the more fun or not fun, but interesting things are that you worked on as a music supervisor.
Okay, well, obviously Pitch Perfect is a music supervisor's dream, first and foremost.
Right.
So, you know, with those movies, we had artists writing original compositions. Thea wrote a song for us. We had medleys, you know. We just had so much music. It was wall-to-wall music, and that is just a dream for somebody like me, from doing the deals, all of it. It's just a dream. So that is interesting, you know, and that's interesting because it's a cappella, and we've got arrangers and producers telling us which songs will make good arrangements and, you know, which ones won't and why. You know, projects are fun for different reasons. I did a beautiful period piece I love called Stone of Destiny. That's about the stone of Scone. Do you know this story, Mark?
No, I don't.
There's a stone in a chair in a very famous church in London. I think it's Westminster Abbey, and it actually belongs to Scotland. It was from a Scottish castle, and the English stole this huge boulder Really, it's a huge, huge stone from the Scottish when they conquered Scotland in 1700, whatever that was, and they took it back to London. So these college students over Christmas break in 1947 or something, break in and steal this giant boulder and get it into the back of a car and drive it back to Scotland. That's called
Stone
of Destiny.
That is so awesome. I'm going to have to watch that.
And we use modern music, right? Like there's the beautiful montage with lots of aerial shots. They went up in a helicopter one day, and I used the contemporary song because it worked, you know? So that's fun. I did a TV show in Canada where we didn't have a score composer. I said, let's use all the instrumental versions from the song and use those as the score. So if I licensed the song for an episode, I would put in a deal. It could be used as many times as we wanted in that episode only for that fee. So we could bring back the theme, the violin or the piano part of it or percussion, whatever we want later on in the episode, which was super groovy. You know, that's a really great way to do a TV show.
It's really interesting how music can evolve in a project, right? You have one idea and then it goes into a direction that, you know, ends up turning out way better than what the original thought was. How often does it happen where you have one sort of idea of what the type of music's going to be, and then it just sort of changes based on serendipity or based on what you've been able to find?
Half the time, at least. Sometimes cues are locked in. That's curious too, though, right? Like writers write them in from when they're writing the script, and the song does actually make it into the film. So that's why it's not all the time that it changes. But I'd say half the time. You know, you try something against picture once it's shot that you think is going to be great in pre-production, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, of course. You know, when you think about it in your head as a screenwriter, and you say, or, you know, a director or whatever, and you think to yourself, wow, you know, this actually would sound great with that song, and then it's tense, and then everybody goes, no, it's not going to work. And you have to come up with some sort of alternative, and that's really where your job actually gets fun, right? I mean, that's like one of the more fun things is that you can go and sort of play creative detective and really figure out how to make impactful music that really brings the vision to life.
Yeah, and brings production value too. You know, I always love to bring production value through the music.
That actually is a really interesting insight, I think, for people to know that about half the time, what's originally envisioned is not what ends up happening by the time, you know, post-production is wrapped. And that, to me,
half the time.
Yeah.
It goes both ways, right? Like, you'll lose cues, but then you'll gain cues. So cues that you think are going to be super important that you have big songs for, it just changes. It depends on the director, really, and how, you know, well-schooled, well-experienced the director is and the producers and wrangling the director and all that good stuff.
And that's another thing that people have to remember. You know, we didn't really talk about it that much, but there are a lot of cooks that are always going to be in the
100%
in the kitchen. And people have to be aware of that because,
you know,
so many people look at your job and they say, I need to connect my music with a music supervisor because the music supervisor is this musical overlord that, you know, if they decide that they like the music, then it's going to be in a show or it's going to be in a film. And that's not really how it works because you've got so many other people involved. If it's, you know, a TV production or if it's a film production, you've got not only the showrunner or the director, the screenwriters got input. Sometimes the actors have input if they're bold.
The editor, the
head
network
of marketing.
Executives, the studio, marketing, the lawyers. Oh my God, lawyers will tell me what they think should go in. And it's like, really? Why doesn't hair and makeup come in here and tell me what to put in here?
I mean, it's like at the end of the day, you might get an edict that comes down from an executive producer. Hey, you know what? You should try this song because my kid liked it.
I'll tell you what the worst is too, is that when people come and they say, look, my kid recorded this and it's a cover and it's like Stand By Me literally, or something as equally expensive. You're on a little Canadian TV show and the actor who's in the show, who's also taking a producing credit, is telling you to put the kid's song in the show, and you're trying to explain it's a cover. We have to buy the publishing, which is not understood and doesn't go over well. Basically, we're the bad guy. I mean, we can look like the genius rarely, but most of the time, in my experience, I'm always the bad guy, right? You can't have that song, it's too expensive. We're not going to be able to make that work.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, you're the bad guy, but at the end of the day, you're also the fixer because you bring the alternative. You make it so that, you know, look, at the end of the day, not all is lost. You've got more will than you've got wallet over here, Mr. Showrunner. So, you know, we've got to be honest with ourselves and what we can do, and here's the direction of where we can go. People think it's just a creative job in a lot of ways, but there's so much that goes into it in terms of not only understanding how music goes to picture, but also understanding IP and understanding business development and understanding interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, accounting, nonviolent communication. Yeah,
egos.
How to communicate. Yeah.
We know how creative people are, and this is not a diss to creative people, but people like their work. You know, they put a lot of time and invested a lot of time into it,
yeah.
A lot of love into it. And if they're not getting the exact thing that they want, and you're the person who's saying to them, look, we've got to go in another direction, it's not the easiest thing to do. It really, it calls for a great deal of skill that not a lot of people
have. It does.
You
know what? It's so misunderstood, Mark. It's so misunderstood. I can't tell you how many people have come to work with me, how many people have interned for me, how people I speak with on your panels, you know, when I travel go and speak at these wonderful conferences. And you need such a diverse set of skills. You have to be such a go-getter because, again, I can't stress enough, you have to be able to go and land the job or there is nothing to music supervise. So unless your brother is a director or your sister owns a production company or your cousin owns a video game developer, you know, it's hard to get in unless you know what you're doing. And that comes from having a love of music and, you know, having a love of business and, you know, being deeply creative as well. Like, there's so much beautiful creative music supervision that goes on, you know.
Yeah,
look what Randall Poster did over the opening credits of Boardwalk Empire, where he is a cake song, isn't it?
Yep.
And it's a period show. Like, there's just so much cool, exciting, so many cool, exciting ideas, I should say, that are going on, and so many cool things people are doing with music. And, you know, it all depends on the budget. And I always tell the filmmakers, if this music is as important as you tell me it is in your show, then the budget will reflect that.
Yeah. A music supervisor's job, if you have a large budget for music.
Yeah.
Is not going to be.
It's even harder.
I can tell you,
I've done it all. I can tell you. Harder because people read online what the budget of the film is. They see who the cast is and they assume that every song is six figures. And it's like, no, we have 70 songs. And I'm straight up, I tell them in my brief, this is what the licensing budget is, this is what the film budget is, and this is what the budget for this queue is.
Right.
And then they can see my whole picture and they say, but your music licensing, I'm just such a straight shooter. It just saves so much time. I just do straight business, right? This is what
right.
I have. And people say, you can pay this, you have that much money. And I'm like, no, dear, I got two Michael Jackson songs. I got whatever, Madonna. And I have 50, you know, 60 other songs. Like, work with me. Let's work it out.
I think that's such an important point for people to consider. And people don't like this point, okay? But it's reality. Is that
it's all reality.
You may have a big budget film that you're supervising, but the fact is that unless you are the lawyer or the label or the publisher that's representing Led Zeppelin, which is going to be a lot of money if you're going to put it into a film, you shouldn't expect, just because you know that it's a big budget film, that you're going to get the same amount of money. You should be realistic about what will be given to you. You'll probably get a decent amount of money, but it's not going to be like what a name brand band is going to get.
You know, here's what licensors should ask. Licensors should always ask. They should empower themselves, Mark. They should empower themselves with
anything. I think so. Yeah.
Here's some, and this is why you do Think Summit. And here's some questions they can ask. When my friends say somebody wants one of their songs, I say, here's the questions to ask. What's your budget for the queue?
Yep.
So you don't even have to quote on it. You can ask the supervisor, what's your budget for the queue? You're going to know how many other co-publishers you have. You can ask if anyone else is already approved. You can sort of get an idea of what your co-publishers or the master or whatever is quoting. And if you own 100% on all sides, you can say, what are other songs of a similar caliber artist, similar sales, similar radio play? What are those artists getting? Because, I certainly don't ever make anything unfair. I make all the shows I've ever done come in on time, on budget, and what the music licenses are paid are relative to one another. So I'm never going to have some huge artist that's with a small publisher and pay them very little money and have a big artist with a big publisher and pay them way more. I keep it all the same. So we all have to agree. So I negotiate all the songs together. I will give information to my licensors. I empower them with education and I say, hey, here's this artist I got from this label and they agreed to this amount. Why don't we go with that? And they say, no, our artist is bigger. And I'm like, great, okay, what about this artist? They sold so many of them. They're getting this for this queue, and it's 30 seconds longer. Why don't we do this? You know, so I'm very open. I just negotiate with people, and it's extremely effective. You know, here's the facts. What do we got? Because you don't want to be digging your heels in over something silly that you don't know about. That's the thing. Because sometimes licensors say, nope. This is a Microsoft ad, or this is a, you know, Ford ad. We need more money. It's like, well, what did they pay for the last ad? That's going to give you a really good idea of what they have in the budget.
Yeah, exactly.
And what it's going to go, like, empower yourself with education. Don't be afraid to ask. That's what I want to say to licensors, Mark. That's what I want to say to labels and publishers. Don't be afraid to ask. When a supervisor comes to you and says, we want your song, say, great. What's your budget for the queue? What are other songs in the project getting?
Right.
Then you have a really good, realistic, logistical, pragmatic idea about what you're going to get and what's a reasonable amount for your license.
You know,
and also, don't forget the back end, because on those big, big movies where you don't necessarily get a huge payday because there's 70 songs in the film, you got to remember the back end. And that's what I told everybody on pitch, too. Our budget was the same. The only increase was for the actors because it's pre-negotiated. So the budget for the film was the same, but people were reading online. It was like 3 times as much. And I had to explain to everyone the cast absorbed all of that increase. The music licensing budget is the same as the first one.
Wow.
Yeah, so everyone was like, oh, Sarah Webster, great to hear from you. I'll take a yacht. And I'm like, listen, I'm driving a Dodge, so that should give you an indication.
It's one of these things where if you're talking about a situation where you're a rights owner and you don't have the information that you need, then you probably are going to have, you know, you're not going to negotiate well. You might end up getting
stabbing in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. And
if you haven't worked with them before.
Yeah. And you have no idea, like, what they're paying one way or the other, and you don't have an understanding of why it's like somebody like you, Sarah, you're paying a lot more money for a Michael Jackson track than you are for somebody who isn't very well known. And the reasons are kind of obvious as to why, but people don't have an understanding. All that they see a lot of the time is like, oh, they're using the Michael Jackson track. Boy, they must have a lot of money in that project.
I know.
And what they don't know is that's like the tip of the iceberg that you see, right? Because underneath that, there's most of the songs that are being used where there isn't a very big budget, and it pays for you to work with the music supervisor in a way that help both of you in the long term, right?
Yep, totally.
Is there anything else that you would want to say to people in terms of what they need to do to put their best foot forward?
Well, I mean, obviously, first and foremost, they want to have the best catalog they can have. You know, if they can mix some known artists in with unknown artists, then that's a really productive way to get, what do we call them, emerging artists involved. Have all your facts, have all your information, know how much of it you own. And if you're going to pitch something that you don't own 100%, for goodness sakes, let the music supervisor know when you're pitching that. When you pitch some songs, you know, I send it a brief and I get songs back, and then I go back to everyone and say, do you have 100%? And it's never yes.
Yeah.
You know, half the time it's Warner Chappell this and Wix and that and so-and-so this. And so it's just like, good grief, you guys need to let me know. That's why I pre-clear everything. So I would just say to put your best foot forward, get the best music in your catalog you can, have all the information, legal information, correct and up to date, pitch productively, just pitch what suits. Empower yourself with education, right?
Yeah.
When I go after a job and I go into a job, I sure know what I'm talking about and I sure know what I'm doing, right? Because
right.
I have to have that confidence to go after it. Do your research and ask questions, because asking questions empowers you. Asking questions gives you information. It is empowering. So I really encourage, especially the indies, Mark, nobody asks me anything. People are just so grateful to get a phone call.
Right.
Really, really, I encourage people to empower themselves to ask questions. What's the budget of the what's the music budget of the entire project? What's the budget of this queue? What are you getting other songs for? And then the supervisor can say, I'm not telling you. And that's the way they operate. And, you know, if you're going to roll with that supervisor, that's the way they roll. And if you ask me, I'll say, well, I'll look at my spreadsheet and I'll be on the phone with you and I'll share what some similar copyrights, you know, so that we can figure it out together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, because that's how you do good business. Because it's very important to me that my licensors feel taken care of. It's very important to me that the artists feel that they're taken care of. And it's also very important to me, my clients, the producers, feel like they're getting good prices and great songs for their projects.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, you need to look like a superstar to your clients, and
totally.
You need to be fair to the people that you're getting music from.
Help me to look like a superstar. Yeah, go find all those expiring deals for big name artists and grab them.
Exactly. Find the big name deals for the expiring deals for big name artists and grab them. I like that. I think that's a good way to end it. Sarah, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm so honored. Thank you.